A podcast of the cinema, and you're Dave White. You review films for the Wrap, and you produce this show.
We came to the decision today
because you're the one always writing things down.
The realization that I am the producer,
imposing a structure upon things.
Yeah,
whereas I'm just loosey goosey.
You're loosey and you're goosey. You're real goosey.
How funky is your chicken?
What is, no, don't, let's listen. I would produce that right out of this. if this were, if I had any control over you whatsoever. I'm not a good producer because I can't tame you.
I see. I won't be tamed.
What is your name?
I'm Alonzo Duralde.
Who are you?
I'm film reviews editor at The Wrap.
What have you done?
And good question. I co-host Who Shot You at the Maximum Fun Network and Breakfast All Day. And this.
I've come to the decision.
Yes.
In addition to the fact that I am the producer of this show.
Yes, you are.
I've come to the decision that you are best suited in life to carry me around on your shoulders like Tiny Tim.
Why do you want to murder me?
I don't. I simply want to be carried around on your shoulders.
My shoulders...
Like Tiny Tim.
My shoulders cannot bear your hulkish form.
I'm a sylph. I'm a feather. A
gossamer.
I woke up the other morning and I thought, that would be a great life. An eternal piggyback ride.
I don't think it was so great for Tiny Tim.
Or shoulder.
I don't think Dickens is saying, look how swell this guy's got it. I think like you're like the old rich lady in Harriet the Spy, played by Eartha Kitt in the film version.
I accept this.
Who thinks that she wants
to agree to these terms.
She wants to spend all day in bed until her doctor tells her she has to, and then she's like, no, I must be active.
I think it would be good exercise for you. I think it would be an everyday treat for me. I think it would bring us closer together as lovers.
My spine is having a hard enough time holding up my own hulkish form. It doesn't need a second one on top. I already have that weird like curvature.
What if,
you know?
But what if it made you stronger? It wouldn't kill you, but it could make you stronger. There's a Britney Spears song. No, a Kelly Clarkson, song.
Please.
She wrote a song about this.
So this
she
is
she invented this
so,
idea.
So basically,
what doesn't kill you makes
if
you stronger.
I have to push the
That's
rock
Kelly
in a
Clarkson's
circle enough times
of life,
I will turn into Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah,
yeah, doesn't work that way.
I mean, she may have gotten that idea from someone else. Who knows?
I think Nietzsche got there first, but
sure, whoever,
whatever. Did he have a top 10 hit? I don't think so.
But think about it. Consider the possibilities of how great our life would be together if you were always carrying me around on your shoulders.
No.
Like on one shoulder. Like I would just sort of like perch.
Have you seen yourself in the mirror?
Singing.
Are you a dog who does not understand his size relative to other dogs? Are you the
and
alpha
like
chihuahua
the film,
at the dog park who makes the St. Bernards kneel in cower and fear?
That's right. In just like in the film Scrooge, you could be singing a jaunty little tune while you carry me about.
Oh, I'm supposed to be breathing also while doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah, none of this is happening.
I don't know. I think I'm onto a great
of your productorial ideas, this was one of the worst ones.
This is going to be good. It's going to be good for both of us.
No.
You know what I really love?
Tell me.
Light opening weekend releases.
Yes.
Like when there's nothing opening really that anyone really cares all that much about.
Yeah.
It gives you and me like a freedom. Like I don't feel burdened by this episode.
Are you saying the other episodes are a burden?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I'm saying that when we begin, when we're like 30 minutes out from starting a show, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, do I have enough things written down? Do I have enough notes? Do I have my facts all in a row? And as people who've listened to the show for a long time know, I often don't, but I try.
We often forget that we even saw a movie and then have to catch up with it the following week, which is bad producing, by the way.
I didn't say I was the best producer. I'm the one that makes effort.
Fine.
Yeah. So this weekend, the only two big movies that opened were the remake of Snoopy Come Home, called Annabelle Come Home.
If only.
And Yesterday.
Yes.
Which is about a beetle. So, and I didn't even bother to see Annabelle Come Home because I've already seen Snoopy Come Home, so I don't care. Like, you can't, I know how it ends already. She comes home. Charlie Brown or whoever is in the movie with her is so happy to see her again. She's Annabelle. She goes and sleeps on her little house.
Annabelle is the little red-haired girl. When you think about it.
I know, you know who Annabelle is? Annabelle is the unseen cat that's always taking entire giant swaths
out of the doghouse.
Chunks out of the doghouse. Yeah.
Could be.
So in Annabelle Come Home.
Yes.
Who wants her to come home?
Annabelle comes home. It's not that anyone
spoils the whole movie, doesn't it?
No one's asking her to come home. She comes home.
No one asked her to come home?
No one asked her.
Then why'd she do it?
Because Vera Farmiga. That's why. Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson pop up at the beginning to sort of remind us that this is taking place ish after the first Annabelle movie and around the beginning of the first Conjuring movie. Anyway.
How many Annabelle movies have there been, though?
This is now the third Annabelle standalone movie.
What's the first one? Just Annabelle?
Just Annabelle. And that's the cruddy one that I didn't see.
And then in the second one, we learned that she has a last name.
Annabelle Creation.
Her name
right?
is Annabelle Creation.
Just like Jonathan Grooming. And then now there's Annabelle Comes Home.
Right.
So, yeah. So it begins with them, you know, bringing her back from some nuttiness. And, you know, Annabelle causing some funky things to happen in the car. Some ghouls and an almost accident with a truck.
And that's in the first opening sequence.
Oh yeah. Because
but that doesn't tip them off.
Well, no. They know she's bad news. That's why they're bringing her home. They're bringing her home to put in the room of
put
evil
her in
trophies.
A box in a cemetery in a different country somewhere. How about that?
Look, the Conjuring movies operate under the presumption
that we're safe now.
That Catholicism is a superpower. That you don't have
we're
to.
We're safe now, as long as she stays in her little cage.
You don't need.
Annabelle stays in her box, and we're all.
You
safe.
Don't need laser beam eyes if you have like holy water and some prayers, right. And they put her in a box made of chapel glass.
Seriously, chapel glass.
Chapel glass.
When did that become a?
I don't
a magic
know.
Property,
but seriously, like so many movies where you would never ever just buy into like, oh, I have magic powers, or I have a spell, or I have some you know. Mystic runes or whatever.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, okay, sure. You have to, unless you go fully into a world like that, you wouldn't buy it in a movie that was supposed to be otherwise set on our planet.
Right.
But boy, if it's an exorcism movie, you can Catholic it up like crazy, and we're all like, oh, sure. Yes. Absolutely. That's what Catholics can do.
This is why.
Stem the tide of Satan.
This is why. Episode one of Los Espookies. The TV show that Alonzo and I love the most right now.
Mm-hmm. And a priest hires them to make a fake exorcism so he can be more popular. So the Warrens bring Annabelle back to the Room of Evil. We're told in an opening crawl, after she gets put in the chapel glass, this opening crawl tells us that there is so much pure evil contained in this room that it must be blessed once a week.
By whom?
A priest.
Blesses this place.
A priest. We see a priest throw some holy water on Annabelle.
Any old priest?
I'm sure they have a guy. They have a guy. You know, the diocese has them hooked up with the guy who comes over once a week to do the room
you
blessing.
You better bring in Damien. Is it Damien?
From The Exorcist?
From The Exorcist.
Yes.
Yeah. You better bring him in. You want anything accomplished.
So here's a story about, you know, having mundane tasks performed by the Catholic Church. My mother, my sainted mother, bless her soul,
yes,
went to church every day. She was that lady.
Can you explain that? How does that work? Like, is there a mass every day? Yeah,
well, it would usually be her and two other old ladies right. in, like, the sacristy in the back.
But is it a planned, scheduled thing?
Oh, yeah.
So on the little sign in front of the church, mm-hmm. it says daily what?
Oh, I don't...
What's it
we
called?
We didn't really have the sign. I think it was just like it was...
Then how did people know it was happening?
Because it was in the... You'd get the bulletin every week, and it would have the hours
okay.
of stuff.
Got it.
So yeah, like
what's that called? The daily thing. What's it called?
Liturgy. I don't know. I haven't been a Catholic in a very long time. So she would go every day, and it would be like I said, like her and a couple other old ladies and the priest, and they do a little, you know, they'd sort of sit in a circle and do a mass. Like it wasn't like the whole full up and down the aisle kneeling.
Well, you're not going to do that for three people.
No, of course not. That would be de trop. So anyway, so the priest
was it the same time every day?
I think so. Yeah.
Morning.
Yeah, like 9 a.m.
You know what? I see that.
Sure.
I see that as a nice, like, first of all, you've got seven children.
Little daily re-up.
You've got seven children and a demanding husband. I just know. I wasn't there, but I just know. From the year plus that I knew your father, I know. So look, you've got eight people to tend to.
And the minute you get them
all out of the house, you think, okay, going to church. This is me time.
I was saying, by the time I was in high school, they were pretty much empty nesters, you know.
Right. Still, though.
Yeah.
No.
It wears on you.
You need a break. Yeah.
Anyway, so the priest asks my mother to wash the altar cloths. Mm-hmm. And she's like, sure, fine, whatever. And this guy, I don't know where he gets off on this one, but he goes, now, remember, these have to be washed separately.
Right.
And they need to be rinsed three times, because, you know, the Catholics love threes
and
sevens.
Did your washing machine have a three-timey?
No, like, she was supposed to sort of, like, go through and put it through three cycles.
Well, that's a lot of water.
Well, and so my mother goes, oh, sure, yeah, no problem. She tosses him in with the towels, gets him one rinse,
right.
dries him. He never knows the difference.
Of course not.
So I'm just wondering, if you're the guy at the local parish and your gig is, oh, by the way, once a week you have to go to the Warren's house and bless their room of evil artifacts, at what point do you start phoning it in? Okay, we're good.
The sign of the cross.
I got a tea time.
You got, yeah.
So anyway.
Is there cake today? Did anyone bake me something?
So it's the early 70s. They put the doll in the Room of Evil stuff. And of course, then go on some trip where they leave their young daughter, who's played by McKenna Grace, who was young Tanya Harding in I, Tanya.
Yes.
With her babysitter. And of course, like, her birthday's coming up and everybody in her class is treating her weird because, like, the newspapers have started covering what the Warrens do and everybody thinks there's, like, hinky, weird, you know, voodoo hocus pocus going on over there.
Well, there is.
Well, it turns out that...
Is it still the 70s?
It's still the 70s.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So there's, at least the outfits are still cool.
Oh, yeah. If you were to see this movie for anything, as with La Llorona,
right.
It's for the house.
Oh, it's a good house?
Oh. Split level, shag carpeting, the yellow glass with, like, the patterned, opaque patterns in it, you know?
Yeah. I like a set decoration. Well,
when it comes on cable, you can watch it for that.
All right.
So anyway, so the Babysitter's played by Madison Eisman, who was in the new Jumanji. She's in a movie called Riot Girls. We're about to show at Outfest.
All right.
Her best friend, played by Katie Sarif, recently lost her father and wants to communicate with him. So she finds the keys on the desk and goes into the room of evil things. And of course, like, touches everything, which you're not supposed to do. So like, everything comes to life or comes out, escapes the room, blah, blah, blah. You're basically dealing with a haunted house movie.
Okay.
And three frightened girls, as William Castle might have said. and the three frightened girls are the best thing in it. Like, the three actresses are really good. Katie Sarif was on Supernatural. She was in an ABC Family movie called Teen Spirit. I've never really seen her before, but she's great. Madison Eisman, McKenna Grace, they're all like giving actual performances in a movie that can barely bother to do anything with them. It's a lot of running around and screaming, but between that, you know, you care about these people and you understand what they're about. I kind
of
like...
In the absence of it being scary, because I already know without having seen it that it's not scary.
Yeah.
Why would you bother?
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I have a much lower scare threshold than
sure
you do. And I
That's
wasn't
one of the, if I had gone to see it at all, it would have been with you. You know, for the pleasure
to watch me.
For the pleasure of sitting next to you during a movie that makes you jump and go, "Ee!"
To be honest, I didn't squirm that much. And maybe my heart wasn't in it. Like, I saw it after a long day of work or something.
That's part of the investment, right?
Yes. You know, and I do
meet it on its level.
I do often like the Conjure movies. I liked the second Annabelle. I liked the two of the Conjurings. Not so much The Nun or La Llorona, but, you know, I kind of dig what they're about. And there were, I thought, some effective, spooky things. And the whole backstory with the girl with the dead father is interesting and it's explored. It's not just like, oh, I miss my dead dad. Like, there's a whole guilt element involved. But yeah, ultimately, it falls very safely into what we would call the slumber party horror movie. You know, it's not that scary and it's... You know, I think if you're going to see it at all, it's for the performances and for the set decor and, you know, some of the 70s, like, outfits. But it's rated R, which is weird because I guess gore. I guess there's some gore, maybe. Mm. But, you know, this seems like this should have been aimed at the Ouija audience, basically.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Fine, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm just not. There's no such thing as a scary doll that.
Well,
means
the,
a damn thing.
The thing,
is,
the doll is not the central. Like, once all the havoc happens, all these other things manifest. Like, there's a werewolf, and there's a,
right.
You know, there's a bloody bridal gown that stabs people and stuff. So yeah, Annabelle kind of because she doesn't do anything. You know, she just sort of.
Stares at you.
They don't dwell on her too much. But, you know,
I mean, I haven't even gotten around to going to see Child's Play yet. I said I was going to go this week, and then I was just like, time. But I'm going tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, tomorrow afternoon I'm going with a friend.
Knock yourself out.
And, because I'm interested, just because Aubrey Plaza is in it.
Well, sure.
Dig her, you know. But, yeah, yeah. Y'all can keep these Annabelles. She can come home, go away, go on a journey, on a trip somewhere else.
Annabelle and Otis.
Go hang out with Paddington 2, Paddington 3.
Ooh.
Look, he would give her the stern stare.
And then she would behave.
She'd behave.
Yeah, maybe. I would like to think so.
You don't. Listen. There is no... here's the thing. These people, these conjuring people... All they need is to bring Paddington into the room. He'll make everything nice and good. Evil cannot win.
Like he did with that prison.
Yeah. He can take a whole prison and make it a happy place.
Yeah. They made lovely desserts.
Yeah. Anyway. We had this big idea today. It's akin to the big idea of having seen Child's Play.
And then it didn't happen.
And then it did not happen. We had this big idea this morning. We're going to get up. We're going to record Linoleum Nights. Then we're going to go off to Santa Monica. And we're going to go to the Royal. And we're going to see the new Carlos Reigadas film, Our Time. That's the name of it. I like his movies.
I have not seen one. Did I see Post Tenebras?
You tell me.
I keep thinking that I have, but I'm not sure that I have.
I understand what you're getting at, because people will throw out titles of films to me that came out last year, 3 years ago, 10 years ago, and I'll say, "What's that?" And they'll say, "Oh, it's this movie with blah 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 and blah blah blah." They'll list the actors. They'll start talking about the plot of the movie, and I'll say, "Oh yeah, I saw that." And I couldn't tell you one thing about it. I don't remember a damn thing about whatever movie it is you're talking about. So anyway, we were going to go see that. And then I took a nap. And that sort of blew that out of the water, that whole plan. The nap took over.
Well, sometimes your Sunday just got to be given over to a nap. Sorry, I have not seen Post and Brussels. I've not seen any of this guy's movies.
Okay, well, anyway. So.
Plan B.
Now I've been reading up on, critical stuff about Ray Gatiss. He's a Mexican filmmaker. He made...
Japón.
Silent Light. Battle in Heaven. Post Tenebra Lux. And now this one. And I've seen Battle in Heaven and I've seen Post Tenebra Lux, but I have not seen Japón and I have not seen Silent Light. So I started reading up on Silent Light because that's the one that everyone says, oh, yeah, like,
And it's on Criterion Channel.
Check that one. And yeah, Japón and Silent Light and Battle in Heaven are all currently on the Criterion Channel. Mm. And as I'm reading up on Silent Light, the writer's talking a lot about a film that I'm pronouncing in my head as Ordet. It's a Danish word. It means the word. And I just looked it up on the internet and got the internet lady to pronounce it for me, and she says Ordet. So with no R sound. Anyway... They keep talking about this Carl Theodore Dreyer film from 1955 called Odette. And Ray Gatiss himself says, well, Silent Light is really Odette's little brother. And I thought, well, I'm not going to watch Silent Light before I see
Odette.
So instead of going out to see the new Ray Gatiss film, you and I sat down on the couch at lunchtime. And started watching. Also, did I say it was also on the Criterion Channel?
You're saying it now.
I'm saying it now. Odette is also on the Criterion Channel. We started watching it. 15 minutes in, you fell asleep. And
I did not.
And then you went and took a nap. A little nap. And then we picked it back up again.
I said, how far in are we? And we were 40 minutes into a full two-hour movie.
Yes.
And I was like, I cannot.
We were 20 minutes in.
No, it was 40.
You sure?
It was 40.
Anyway.
I said, I cannot. And I need a nap.
So you had yourself a little nap.
Because this is a Danish film with... long takes.
Very long takes. Yes. Like 5, 6, 7 minute takes.
Yeah.
1955.
Mm-hmm.
Long takes. Austerity.
Ooh.
In motion. Or not in motion. If you will.
Go ahead.
Anyway. I've just had my head spun around by this film. It is the story of a rural Danish farm family, and all signs point to them being fairly prosperous. Like they are well regarded in around them as like sort of prosperous people.
Yeah,
and it's an old father, one son and his wife and their two children, one son who is not yet married. And then one son who thinks he's Jesus.
Yes.
And they put the blame on the son who thinks he's Jesus on he has studied too much Kierkegaard. So, they run afoul of some fundamentalists in the village. And the reason this happens is because the youngest son wants to marry the daughter of the main fundamentalist.
Yes.
He's the tailor in town. And
I said, these people need a Babbitt's feast pronto.
The whole town does. Like, it's not just that the fundamentalists are dour. Even the farm family who are meant to represent, you know,
the joyous Christianity.
Joyous Christianity, you're like, y'all could use a little disco dance party in your life too, if you know what I mean.
But the farmer refers to the tailor and his ilk as being like the holy sour people.
Yeah, yeah. And you're watching the whole thing thinking exactly what you just said. Where is Babette and why isn't she already making a feast for all of these people to calm them down?
Yeah.
So, tragedy strikes. I won't say what the tragedy is. Because this classic film that I have only just now seen for the very first time in my life is something that I cannot recommend highly enough.
Oh, yeah.
It is, first of all, a stunning act of filmmaking. And it has plot elements that will turn your head around.
Yeah.
First of all, things that you would never see in an American 1955 movie. Subjects they would never broach
right.
in an American film from 1955. And an ending that you do not see coming.
No. I need to do more research on this because I can't decide if this is a movie that influenced Ingmar Bergman or that Ingmar Bergman hated. Like, it could go either way.
Well, I thought, like, as we were watching the film, I thought I had read somewhere once that Bresson was not into Dreyer.
Yeah.
Even though
Paul Schrader,
Dreyer, Bresson, and Ozu are the subjects of Paul Schrader's book, Transcendental Style in Film.
And Schrader says that Odette is the most Ozu / Bressonian of all of the Dreyer films.
Absolutely. And that's clear. Yeah, you know, it's hard to know who hates who.
But, I mean, because on the one hand, there are stylistic choices here that feel very Bergman, that have that sort of Scandinavian austerity.
Oh, yeah.
On the other hand, given that Bergman wants to make films about God's silence and stuff.
Right.
Not sure how this one played out for him.
No, you know Bergman did not like this. Yeah. In terms of, like, what goes down.
Sure. Thematically, yeah.
Because you are asked to accept a lot of things. This film takes you to a whole lot of different places, and they are places that might seem in diametrical opposition to one another. There's a lot of paradoxical situations going on, a lot of contemporary feeling grief and despair.
And this is based on a play that was written in 1925 or something. This is actually the second film version.
And there is also a story of faith taking place that will satisfy absolutely no one.
Yeah, it travels in places that far lesser contemporary, quote-unquote, faith-based films would try to do. Oh,
these movies can't carry this one's luggage.
Oh, heavens no.
This is deep stuff here that is not meant to be understood on a surfacey literalist level.
No.
It's staggering, and I can't believe I'm 55 and only seeing it now for the first time.
Mm.
But I'll watch this again.
Yeah.
Because I'll take... this is the kind of movie I'd love to force on people, honestly.
Well, you know, it's funny because about midway through, I was reminded of, like, and he didn't invent this, but Todd Alcott, who I follow on, you know, Facebook and on Twitter, and has written a lot of really interesting things because he's a screenwriter, and he will analyze films from a screenwriter's perspective, always sort of asking the question, what does the protagonist want?
Yes.
And midway through this, I'm like, who is the protagonist? because it's not is entirely
it,
clear.
Is it God?
God?
David? So, yeah. It'll spin you right round.
Oof.
I am now ready to watch Silent Light.
Yeah, I guess so.
And then eventually, somehow, some way, Our Time.
Yeah.
That thing is 3 hours long. And that was one of the reasons why when I woke up from the nap and it was just like, if we were going to go, we were going to go right then.
Uh-huh.
You know how you wake up from a nap and you're like, don't make me do or think anything right now?
Yeah. See, you wonder why I get cross with you sometimes in the morning.
No, I don't wonder. I know why.
Yeah, sometimes you pepper me with questions and demands. I'm like,
you're a grumpy, cranky baby.
No, not yet. Brain not on all the way.
You're a grouchy toddler.
I'm not a grouchy toddler. You've just been awake for 3 hours because you're a crow.
I like to think of myself as a morning dove. Rather than a crow. Perhaps a well-fed pigeon.
You're a strutting rooster. A strutting popinjay.
So we watched yesterday.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, y'all, watch Odette, O-R-D-E-T.
Yeah, it's on the Criterion Channel.
Tell us what you think.
From the director of The Passion of Joan of Arc.
So, Danny Boyle and Richard Curtis.
Yes.
Did you ever dream about them teaming up and doing something together? Did you ever think, I sure would like to see these two guys
not in
make
the
a movie
slightest.
Together?
No.
It seems to me like, in spite of the fact that they represent...
diametric.
They represent two types of the UK
cinema,
two different
flavors,
sort of like parallel tracks, right?
Sure, yes,
that should not meet.
Well, I'm surprised that Richard Curtis is writing for other directors because he started
out that way,
but usually. I mean, believe me, this is the first and only time I'll compare him to Preston Sturges. But very frequently, once you are a writer who starts directing, you direct everything you write. You don't want to just hand it off. Like, you can always tell that a movie's going to suck when the Coen brothers wrote it and then let somebody else direct it. Like, Suburbland. What was that awful George Clooney movie a couple years ago?
I forget.
Suburbicon.
Oh, yeah.
Suburbicon, that terrible remake of Gambit that nobody saw.
I never saw that.
Yeah, I mean, so often it feels like if you are an auteur and you have a script that you walk away from, it means you're. I tend to think you're acknowledging it's a turd. I'm sure there are exceptions, but anyway, so I thought that Richard Curtis, now that he is a director, would just be a writer director from now on. So the fact that he wrote something and didn't direct it already seemed odd. And then that it was Danny Boyle directing it was sort of, really?
Now, I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that Richard Curtis is, you know, nummy, 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 and Danny Boyle is like, edgy man, because Danny Boyle has proven...
No, they are both very mass market.
Time and time again, that he is not...
one thing.
He is not just one thing, right. But Richard Curtis is one thing, and that is nummy, 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 nummy. That's Richard Curtis. Tell me I'm wrong. So, yesterday is a Danny Boyle movie that goes. It stars.
Himesh Patel,
Who I had never seen before because I
don't watch EastEnders.
Because I don't live in the UK and I don't watch EastEnders, which does not air in the United States.
No.
But EastEnders is a television program that has been on for 1,000 years.
Yes. I believe it started under the Cromwell era.
I don't know when it started, but it's been on. Like, is Coronation Street still on?
I think it is.
Okay.
I think.
Because
I'm not sure.
Those two.
Yeah, those are the
little side by side
staples of UK television.
Anyway, he's on EastEnders for a very long time. And he's been in some other stuff that I've never seen.
Coronation Street is still on.
Right. And started when?
1960.
It began in 1960?
Yeah. And EastEnders started in... Well, that can't be right. It says 1985. That's not true. Is it?
Maybe.
Okay.
That's still a long time, though.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally.
Yeah. In any case, I... This... I cannot tell right now if Himesh Patel is a good actor or not.
Yeah, I wouldn't base it solely on this.
All I can say is that based on this movie, he is a human-shaped vacuum of air. who has been tasked with starring in a movie because he can play a musical instrument or two, right? Is he a good musician?
Apparently.
Perhaps.
That's... He is very convincing as an unsuccessful singer-songwriter.
He's very convincing as just some mediocre dude. Now, that's either a great performance or he's that guy. And I can't tell.
And it's not like the movie knows
helping
it.
Him.
Yeah, it's not a thing where like, oh, he's just a regular dude who is thrust into these extraordinary circumstances. I mean, that's the plot of the movie, but that's not, the performance doesn't reflect somebody average being thrust onto the world stage. It just feels like they cast somebody sort of average in the role.
So here's what it's about. He plays a guy who is a struggling musician. He cannot get any traction whatsoever. He is a former school teacher, and his longtime best friend
slash manager
is also a school teacher. She's played by Lily James. Question. It's kind of a puzzle question, so I'll give you a minute to think of an answer.
Okay. Keira Knightley.
Who was Keira Knightley before Keira Knightley was Keira Knightley, and who will be Keira Knightley after Lily James is finished being Keira Knightley? Go. What's the answer?
Who was the previous Keira Knightley? Was it Kate Beckinsale?
Was Kate Beckinsale the first Keira Knightley?
Well, not the first. I think there's been a series of Keira Knightleys over the course of cinematic history. Sylvia Sims was Keira Knightley at one point.
I say this as a Keira Knightley fan.
Yes.
I like her. I even like her in that weird Cronenberg movie about Freud.
A Dangerous Method.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, this movie is dying to turn Lily James into Keira Knightley, while at the same time trying to pass her off as like just a regular gal, even though she's played by Lily effing gorgeous James. So they give her a somewhat unflattering hairdo and think that's going to do the
trick. Oh, it's
just
dark brown.
Well, like they give
her
these...
It's her Little Woods hair.
They give her these weird clumps of curls on top. They're sort of dorky.
They're trying to indie her up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's...
Okay, so anyway. He's a struggling musician. She is his manager and best friend, and she pines for him.
Yes.
And the whole time you're thinking, girl,
what? You're Lily James.
You're Lily James. Have you not looked in the mirror lately? You're Lily James.
And he pines for her, but neither of them
does.
Does
he really pine for her, though? Like, he's so locked away from his own feelings about her, he doesn't even understand pines for her. He doesn't pine for her until later in the film.
I guess.
Anyway, he is riding his bike home one night from a failed
gig.
And there's a power outage, and it's not just a power outage on the block or in the city, not just in the whole country. It is a worldwide power outage. Everything goes down for whoever knows
how long.
5 or 10 seconds. He gets hit by a bus. He gets thrown, 100 feet, winds up in the hospital, two front teeth knocked out. Mm-hmm. And something weird has happened. during the time of the power outage, and the film never explains why, but the Beatles have been historically erased from the world. Their songs, they were never a band. Their songs do not exist. They never recorded anything. They never, like, apparently never met, whatever. Now, when he goes onto the internet after he recuperates and strums his guitar to his friends and sings the song Yesterday, and they all say, "Wow, you wrote a beautiful song. That's the most beautiful song I've ever heard." And he's like, no, that's from the Beatles. And they're like, "Who?" He goes onto the internet and types in the Beatles, and up comes the bug. And then he types in the band Oasis, and they have never existed either. Which, I must say, is an easy go-to laugh, but it did make me laugh.
There are a few earned chuckles in this.
Then he takes this opportunity to start performing Beatles songs for anyone who will listen, as though he wrote them. Now, he has to do this all entirely from memory.
Yes.
Because he can't go to his record collection.
Because they're gone.
Those records are gone. And bit by bit, he becomes famous for this.
He opens for Ed Sheeran.
Ed Sheeran comes to him.
Yeah.
And says, "I've heard these songs."
He plays one on like local TV. Like, yeah. This is Norwich or whatever.
Ed Sheeran knocks on his door and says, "Hello, I'm Ed Sheeran. I want to help you.
I need somebody to open for me in Moscow in 2 days.
So he goes on tour with Ed Sheeran, and then he gets a record deal, and Kate McKinnon becomes his agent. And there are two mystery people following him around during the entire film.
Yeah.
And you know what they're about just by the way they look at him and stare at him. And they're always sort of leaning in to try and figure out what's going on with him. And you don't need someone to explain to you that they know the secret.
Right.
But you don't know what they're going to do with that secret.
Yeah. What kind of stakes are.
And I won't tell you what they do with the secret. Only that what they do with the secret is simultaneously trying to have its cake and eat it too. And giving, and it reduces the film to no stakes whatsoever.
Well, basically, yeah.
And so,
you have this potentially intriguing premise, you know,
yeah.
the massive cultural footprint of the Beatles, and what would the world like be without it? And the movie is only glancingly interested in this because it really wants you to care about the love story between Himesh Patel and Lily James, which is all well and good if that's the kind of bait and switch you're going to pull, except we have to give the tiniest of Fs about that love story, which we do not.
I don't. No, I don't. I care more about what's going to happen when he's discovered.
Yeah.
And when the one other person in the world, or in this case, the two other people in the world, come to him and say, "We know what you're doing."
Right. And there's a moment that's very Richard Curtis-y that I think, in the right, handled well, could have brought me to tears and probably is moving some viewers to tears. But
I know the moment you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
I think it's very sweet.
It was fine.
But it's but past, not.
Once the initial shock of it registers, it's sort of like, we don't really have an idea for this.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the whole movie. We don't really have an idea for this, you know? And it also, you know, and other people pointed this out, it assumes that the Beatles' success was based solely on the quality of their songs, which are great.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take into account, like, their performance, their presence, the historical context, you know.
Post-war England.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like the
post-war U.S.,
the end
state of rock and roll in 1960. too.
The teenage, the baby boomers as teenagers, you know,
right.
Vietnam, like all these other factors that play into things, you know, the Beach Boys, you know. And all
there are nine reasons why the Beatles became the Beatles.
Exactly.
And one of those reasons is how great their songs were.
Exactly.
And so.
And this guy's not even like trying to, you know, it would have been one thing if he had started out with like I Want to Hold Your Hand and P.S. I Love You and then worked his way up to I Am the Walrus and Let It Be,
right.
But he's just throwing it all in there together,
right.
Jumping back and forth and like not, you know, evolving. He's just pooping them all out.
Pitchfork would call that debut album incoherent.
Incoat.
No. But it would have been interesting if the film had tried to figure out what the pop music landscape is like without the Beatles ever having existed.
Right.
Like, and if the Beatles came along today with all other things being equal, would they be on the radio? And the answer is not probably.
Yeah.
Not when Cardi B is the dominant force. The Beatles are dad music. They're granddad music, you know? And so it's not.
This is a weird comparison, but like the comic book, the original graphic novel of Watchmen,
yeah,
makes an effort to sort of examine what a world with superheroes would look like,
yeah,
down to the minutiae.
Yeah.
So you have Richard Nixon still being president in 1985 because the rest of the world fears us so much.
Right.
You have pirate comic books being popular because nobody cares about fictional superheroes because we have real ones.
Right.
You have electric cars because you have a guy who can manipulate matter and create lithium in giant quantities for the batteries.
Right.
You know, like all these different aspects of it, down to like even like emigration patterns and stuff. Like, you know, he takes that into account. And this movie doesn't really do that kind of homework.
Along the way, you even learn that there are a handful of other pretty huge cultural things that do not exist.
Correct.
That when he mentions them, everyone
people are like, what?
They're like, what are you talking about?
And it's another go back to Google joke.
And we don't find out, you know, it's a one-off joke each time it happens. And those little things could be, you know, give me two or three more sentences as to what that means to the, yeah, planet. You know, because I'll tell you, if the Beatles don't exist and Oasis doesn't exist, there are like 300 to 500 other bands that don't exist.
Sure.
Either. And so,
or I mean, as our friend Chris said, as we were leaving, if the Beatles don't exist, is Sharon Tate alive?
Charles Manson would have become obsessed with something else.
I suppose. He would have picked, yeah, something off of Pet Sounds or whatever. But,
yeah,
would like, there be a Pet Sounds?
Would there be a Pet Sounds? Right.
Because that was inspired by what, Rubber Soul, right?
I can't remember.
I think Rubber Soul inspired Pet Sounds, and then Pet Sounds inspired Sergeant Pepper.
So I'm not as well. Go on and say what you really feel about this, because I'm not really with you.
I was frankly bored, yeah, by it, because if the gimmick is just to get us into the world and really what we're there for is the love story, I didn't care about the love story. Those two have zero chemistry. Their characters aren't interesting. The decision that the lead guy has to make feels arbitrary and pointless. And the manner by which he makes things right is ridiculous in today's world.
Right.
So yeah, it boiled down to watching this guy do a lot of okay cover versions of Beatles songs for the better part of 2 hours. Like when you get a real Beatles song,
the kind of okay cover versions where you think to yourself, who's buying the soundtrack and why?
I know. Yeah. Like when they played an actual Beatles song under the closing credits, it was like, ah, yes.
Although I gotta say, I bought a record at one of the local record shops once, and I still have it. It's a compilation record from the 60s of really strangely unlikely artists covering Beatles songs. And I've talked about this before. There's a song on this record where Tennessee Ernie Ford covers Let It Be.
Oh, wow.
As a sort of
gospel-y,
martial, like, gospel song.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of moving the way he does it.
No, look, there are a lot of great Beatles covers out there. I have a whole album of you know, easy listening guy Enoch Light doing Beatles covers.
Right, right.
But yeah, but it, you know, and as we've been talking about, there's a whole slew of Beatles without the Beatles movies,
yeah,
like Sgt. Pepper's and Across the Universe and the very bizarre All This in World War II. So I don't know. I wonder who's buying the soundtrack to this. Who's buying the soundtrack to Rocket Man to listen to Taron Egerton sing those songs? I don't get it.
I didn't hate this film.
Okay.
You're right about everything. It's kind of boring. The love story means nothing. And as I said at the very beginning, Himesh Patel is just kind of an empty space.
Yeah. I would like to see him in something else.
But here's what gets me about Richard Curtis's... This is less a Danny Boyle movie than it is a Richard Curtis movie.
Agreed.
Because Danny Boyle, I think, is quite often a very interesting filmmaker.
With a sharp pop sensibility when it comes to culture.
Richard Curtis, as we mentioned,
is mumsy.
That doesn't mean I hate Richard Curtis movies.
No.
It means I know what they are.
Right.
And I know what they're trying to do to me. And sometimes I'll just let them. And so...
So this Love Actually to you?
A good 40% of this movie I spent thinking, oh, that's... That's so sweet. Here's another thing. Those Beatles songs are so good that even though he's not great, you feel the excitement. You feel the excitement of people hearing them for the first time. You feel the excitement of people being confronted with straight up gorgeous things.
Sure.
Right? There's a really wonderfully funny and, kind of moment where Ed Sheeran...
They each have 10 minutes to write a song.
They have 10 minutes to write a song, and he comes back with... What does Himesh Patel come back with? What song?
Oh, with The Long and Winding Road.
The Long and Winding Road. And Ed Sheeran, when it's over, says, "All right, I give up." Like... You're Mozart, I'm Salieri. And because if I sat there watching it thinking, if I'm hearing The Long and Winding Road for the first time, I'm going to start crying.
Yeah.
And so the movie occasionally gets that stuff right.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I will say that the cast does a good job of pretending to be hearing these songs for the first time.
Yeah.
But... I wouldn't put any of those moments up against the scene in Cold War where they dance to Rock Around the Clock for the first time.
Okay, true.
Because that made me feel like I was hearing that song for the first time. And that song's like a total, you know, wallpaper cliche at this point.
Right, right.
But yes, I'll grant you that much.
So anyway, it's... fine. It's fine. I know some friends who are head over heels for this film.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
But we don't see eye to eye on it. It's fine. That's all.
Okay.
And for you, it's less than fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can do a lot worse in the summertime when you're looking for something to go see.
You could also
comfortably chilled, air-conditioned environment.
This is true. But you could also wait and watch it on a streaming platform and not really miss much.
Oh, yeah. It does not need a big screen at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I went to bed last night thinking that you were going to watch some kind of Hallmark movie. But instead you watched Weird Science.
Yeah, their Arrow is putting out a new Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And
is it out yet? Or did you just get an advance?
I got an advance, but it's out soon.
It's out soon.
I'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah, and I hadn't watched it in a long time.
But when you were young.
Yes, when it came out.
You saw it a lot.
I saw it quite a few times. I was a big fan of it.
You were like 17 or whatever?
18, yeah. 18, yeah. The first time I saw that movie was the day I got my wisdom teeth taken out.
That explains a lot.
Yes, maybe I was still doped up.
It's the kind of movie that works best if you're sort of doped up.
Definitely, yeah. And even then, I knew there were sort of like structural issues, and like it was the kind of movie, it was one of the first movies I remember looking at thinking, this is thrown.
I like Curly Sue better than I like Weird Science.
Ooh, I've never seen Curly Sue.
Yeah.
I could tell this movie is thrown together. Like there's, like they were frantically putting something together in the editing room because these pieces don't all quite fit together.
Right.
But I was curious about looking at it again, and oh man, it's I mean, so much of the John Hughes oeuvre is what the kids call problematic, you know. And I mean, obviously those movies meant a great deal to me, and they will always be. I will always associate them with that part of my life. But
right.
You watch them now and it's sort of like, you know, 16 Candles is racist and rapey.
Yeah.
Breakfast Club is kind of rapey as well. And it just is. Sort of, well, there's that whole, as somebody said on my Facebook page, the implied unwilling oral sex moment.
What?
When Judd Nelson is hiding under the table and he sticks his head between Molly Ringwald's thighs and she can't say anything about it because it would give away his presence to the principal.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Just all these here and there just things that are like, eh. You know, but also I think still like his musical supervision was always spot on, mm-hmm. and he got a lot right about teenagedom that other movies at that time weren't doing, certainly in the casting.
That's the thing. In spite of what we now look at as those films, you know, deeply culturally ingrained, you know, stubborn flaws.
Yeah.
And trouble. All of that dressing was in service to, you know, stories about teenage feeling.
Yeah.
Not necessarily teenage fact.
No.
But teenage feeling.
Yes.
So yeah, no, I understand all about cultural context and historical differences in the way people, what the target audiences of those movies would accept in 1985. Four, five, seven, nine, whatever. It's different than what that target audience would accept now.
Definitely.
And it's good that we would not accept that stuff now.
Yeah. And you know, so yeah, this movie gives you like an extended scene of Anthony Michael Hall doing a quote unquote black voice.
Yeah, he is. The extras give you the extended version of that, you said?
There's extended stuff on the DVD, but there's not more of that.
All right.
I'm just saying that it's an extended sequence in the film.
There's an extended sequence in the film where he does that. Yes, I know. And,
in front of actors who are black.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think, you know, back then and even now, not even just back then, it's like even now, like actors of color just put up with a lot to have work.
You know, and
they just like bite their tongue and go through the job and get the job done.
And he does like one line that way in Breakfast Club during the stoner sequence.
Okay.
And apparently John Hughes just thought that was so funny that they like extended it out. And
that's the other thing. White people thought a lot of things were funny.
Yes. In 1985.
Back then. So,
but on the other hand, Kelly LeBrock is genuinely good in this movie.
Okay.
She's very funny. She and for all the sort of troublesome aspects of like these, you know, teen boys creating a woman, she is in charge and has agency.
Yeah.
You know, throughout, which is cool. You get baby Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
In one of his first things.
Right.
You know, and there are still lines that land that don't make you flinch, you know.
Right.
And there's still, but there's also like weird, and you know, like all the Bill Paxton stuff is still fun to watch.
It holds a nostalgic place in your heart.
Definitely. But I'm just saying, like, even if it didn't, I think there are parts that still stand on their own that aren't offensive or weird. But also that movie, like, makes so little sense. Like, even if you just sort of assume, like, oh, because magic,
right.
for a lot of it, yes. it's still like, you've really just got to let it not even care about any bit of script logic in this movie.
I think, you know, if you love films and you want to watch them, you want to watch the films of earlier times.
Yeah.
You know, films of the 90s, which are due for their reckoning.
Oh, yeah.
Real quick.
Just you wait.
Coming up here. But,
You know, look, last week, my DVD pick, sorry not to interrupt you, but my DVD pick was Swing Time.
Yes.
And it was pointed out by Dr. Steve that movie has Fred Astaire doing blackface, which yes. I had forgotten about.
Right.
You know, but you're right. When you look at the past.
If you look at the past, you're going to encounter what the past meant.
Yeah.
And what it meant to the people who are in the film, what it meant to the people who made the film, what it meant to the audience that received the film, and that stuff is going to be in that film.
Yeah, the stories that people thought they could tell to each other, or that they were all on the same page with this.
Yes, and what they really mean is these are the things that white people were on the same page with.
Right,
and so by and large,
yeah,
that's mostly what it comes down to. So you can reject every one of those films, or you can sift through them.
Yeah,
for what put remains your waiters valuable. On. Listen, don't think that when they get to the minstrel number of White Christmas, that I'm not thinking it's a good thing that it's 1954 instead of 1944, because if y'all had made this 10 years earlier, you would have been doing blackface.
Well, and they did, essentially, in Holiday Inn.
Don't get it confused.
Right.
Holiday Inn has a blackface number.
Yes. White Christmas does not. But
you said they, and, well, and that implies that the White Christmas people did. No.
Irving Berlin and Bing Crosby.
Yes. The film White Christmas has a show, has a number where Rosemary Clooney, Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Vera Ellen are all reminiscing about the days of the minstrel show.
Yes. Weren't they awesome?
There are no performers in blackface.
No.
Because the tide had turned a little bit. The corner had turned.
Yeah.
And studios were like, okay, well, we're not going to do that anymore.
Right.
Do you still want to have a number about how great minstrel shows were? Fine. Let's do that. You know? And so it's not as jarring as the scene in Holiday Inn, but you can feel it. You can feel it. You think, like, well, if this were just 10 years earlier, Rosemary Clooney would have been in blackface.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of think.
And you would be, and you'd be sort of mortified by that.
Because, like, if you're watching the movie with no cultural context and not knowing what the term means, you would think a minstrel show was, like, something with a lot of tambourines in it.
Yes. Yes. So, this is the study of any sort of history.
Yeah.
Any kind of cultural history.
Oh, has please. This stuff. The kids who started watching Friends on Netflix and were mortified by it.
I know. And so, what am I trying to say? Go forward intelligently.
Yeah.
And
wait till the people in 2050. Start looking at the movies that are out now. They'll be horrified.
Pretty much. That is what will happen.
We have some letters.
We have some letters. I don't have a DVD pick because
I just
watched Odette.
I was going to put Odette as our streaming pick and Weird Science as our
I did Blu-ray rewatch pick. Battle in Heaven this week, though. That is also on the Criterion Channel. Carlos.
Oh, Regattas.
Regattas film from 2012, I think. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. Yeah, it's about a driver, a limo driver, who works for a general. You never see him. You only see the daughter. He drives the daughter. She's like 20, 18, 19, 20. She's in that age range. She's so rich and bored that she voluntarily works in a brothel.
Oh.
Yeah. And no one knows it except the limo driver.
Okay.
He and his wife are, in spite of the fact that they work for a rich family, they're still pretty poor. And so they have, for money, they've kidnapped a baby.
Oh, okay.
And for, you know, a nice ransom. But off camera, in their custody, the baby dies.
Oh, geez.
And events unfurl from there. But this is less a plot-driven film. If you've watched any Carlos Reigadas films, you'll know that he doesn't care so much about literary plot. You know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. He's more interested in showing you. He's more interested in the visual and sonic properties of filmmaking. And if you have to catch up on where the plot might be going, that's fine. He's the kind of filmmaker where human beings can become symbols.
Mm-hmm.
As easily as they could be, you know,
characters,
fleshed out characters. And at least in this film, he sure does love some provocative imagery. There is actual real oral sex that takes place in this film.
Dang.
And throughout. And so, and it's meant to, you know, be about, you know, the union of these two halves of a fractured world.
Okay. Anyway, Battle in Heaven.
Like I said, it's challenging.
All right.
But I really like it.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you can only see it on the Criterion Channel. I think it may be also available on, like, Vudu or one of those. It's out of print on DVD.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Produce some letters, fool.
Well, I will when I get the the email. Here's some email. Daniel says, thank God it's Friday.
I think you have to read the header first.
Oh. Okay, yes. The subject, you liked Can't Stop the Music, but what about, and here's the body of the text, thank God it's Friday. I know it's not specifically gay, beyond the disco, but I TiVo'd it on TCM and thought it was a lot of fun. At one point, you have Donna Summer. She's my goddess, no matter what. Deborah Winger, Terry Nunn from Berlin, Valerie Landisberg, in the same bathroom. I may be a little drunk. Love the podcast, Daniel. Listen,
a little drunk is probably the best way to enjoy Thank God It's Friday.
I need to explain something to you, Daniel. In 1978, I was 13 years old, and I had almost worn out the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. I bought the 12-inch single of Anita Ward's Ring My Bell because I loved that song so much. I loved Donna Summer more than anything. Disco was what it was for me in 1978. I was in middle school. That was it. I didn't care about no Eagles, no Steely Dan, no Eric Clapton, no Fleetwood Mac. I was not, didn't care.
Led Zeppelin.
None of it. No. No. I went straight from the Partridge Family and other bubblegum pop straight into disco, because I was that age. Elementary school, disco started when I was in elementary school. I remember the first time I heard Gloria Gaynor singing Never Can Say Goodbye. And I thought, what is this and who is this and how can I hear more of it? Oh, it was so good.
Yes.
So I was ready for Thank God It's Friday. I could not have been more excited. Or Thank God It's Friday. I made my dad take me to the record store to buy me the triple album soundtrack
Wow.
of Thank God It's Friday.
Before you saw the movie?
Before I saw the movie. That's how ready I was.
This was a cultural event.
Oh. And I knew that I had chosen well when the film began and the Columbia Pictures logo lady turns animated and starts disco dancing.
That is a great moment in Hollywood history.
It is a wonderful moment in Hollywood history. And this film has the very best song winner of all time. Last Dance is magnificent.
Yes.
And cannot be beaten. The only Donna Summer song better than Last Dance is I Feel Love.
Right.
And so after the disco dancing Columbia lady finished doing her disco dance, then I watched the rest of the movie. And I was 13 and I thought, I know this isn't good. But I'm going to just say that I've had a wonderful time because I am watching Donna Summer perform Last Dance in the middle of the movie, and she seems to be having a great time.
It's like a Love American style episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a Love Boat episode. There's like these four subplots that are all stupid.
They're all stupid.
And yeah, but with great song music in it, you know. Oy, that movie.
I will still watch it if it's on TCM or cable. If I just happen to see, oh, thank God it's Friday. So I'll just sit down and look at it.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
I think it was Leonard Maltin in one of the guides that said that it was the worst movie to ever win an Academy Award.
It might be.
I think Suicide Squad has that title.
Oh,
now.
Suicide Squad is much worse than Thank God It's Friday. Yeah. Now, here is my favorite little cultural footnotes about Thank God It's Friday.
Mm-hmm.
One of the actors in the film.
It's Paul Jabara.
Paul Jabara was not much of an actor.
No.
But he did a couple, he was in a couple things. But he was a songwriter.
Oh, yeah.
And he's the one who won that Academy Award.
Right.
He wrote Last Dance. He wrote the Barbra Streisand song, The Main Event, for the movie The Main Event.
1979.
He wrote It's Raining Men.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So he is the total god of you, basically.
He wrote It's Raining Men. Did I just say he wrote It's Raining
you
Men?
You said that.
He
yes.
wrote No More Tears, Enough is Enough
mm-hmm.
for Donna Summer and Barbra Streisand. Unfortunately.
Yes.
He's no longer with us.
Correct.
He died in 1992. At the age of 44, from AIDS.
Yes.
Yeah. And, but he gave the world beautiful things.
Mm-hmm. And Deborah Winger and Jeff Goldblum are both in that movie.
Jeff Goldblum is in Thank God It's Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Donna Summer does like a 15-minute version of Serge Gainsbourg's Je T'aime One Non Plus.
On the soundtrack?
Yeah. Huh. It's a full side of one of the records.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not great.
Yeah.
It's No Love to Love You, Baby.
Don't you need two people for that song?
Not if you're Donna Summer.
I guess not. She couldn't have brought in, you know, Luther Vandross or something.
She could have, I suppose.
Barry White.
Next letter is from Landon. Hey, David Alonzo. I just watched Knife Plus Heart and Stranger by the Lake on Shudder.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know those were streaming already.
I'm a straight white male.
Oh, well.
And I really enjoyed these gay thrillers. Knife Plus Heart did an awesome job recreating the Italian giallo vibe. Both movies are very graphic, so probably not for everyone. I thought of a great tagline for Stranger by the Lake. Since it's a clean podcast, I'm not sure you can say this, but it puts the ock in Hitchcock.
Yes.
I'll just say that way.
It does indeed. So yes, if you guys have not seen either Stranger by the Lake or Knife Plus Heart,
they're apparently both
on Shudder.
They're so great. We talked about Knife Plus Heart earlier this year when it came out. Dr. Steve Scott. Hello, Dr. Steve.
Hello, Dr. Steve.
Oprah has put me in charge of the committee, so it is my pleasure to announce that this week's award for best lighting of black people goes to The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Good God, that was a beautifully shot film. The color palette reminded me a lot of Moonlight, and if Beale Street could talk, that's absolutely sure. True. In fact, I stayed through the credits to make sure it wasn't the same cinematographer. It was not. But you're fully correct. Yeah, it's beautiful. Such a beautiful movie.
Indeed. The year is half over. I'm just noticing. It's June 30th. It's so crazy.
Okay, Scott says, this is a projection on the internet film culture as a whole, so if this seems aggressive, just know that it's built up frustration that has more to do with the totality, to do with the total than anyone here in person. So we're fixing to get yelled at
apparently
for something.
All right. Okay.
I listen to several film-related podcasts, at least 10, and I've noticed a trend that whenever a movie starring non-white actors or actresses, the director's own race is highlighted. I'm going to pause right here in the letter. I think that is sometimes appropriate and sometimes irrelevant.
I think it's
film by film for me.
Sure. And yeah. I think it has less to do with can white people tell these stories and more about must white people make all the movies?
Yeah. Okay. So let's continue. The Last Black Man in San Francisco, white director. Moonlight, black director. Detroit, white female director. On and on. This isn't a new phenomenon. You'll find reviews from decades back, certainly noting a director's race, like, as mentioned, the surrounding discussion about Spielberg and The Color Purple. My gripe, and really the only reason I'm writing this at all, is that Alonso seemed completely ready to dismiss and disregard Beloved because Jonathan Demme is white.
I think I just questioned that if she were making that movie today, she wouldn't hire a white guy to direct it.
I think she might have hired Jonathan Demme no matter when.
Mm.
I think so. And I'll tell you, I say this because I've seen the film and you haven't.
I understand that, but I'm just talking about strictly for the optics.
Yeah.
As qualified and as on its wavelength as he might have been, I don't think 2019 would hire Oprah. Oprah would hire any white guy
maybe
to
not.
Direct that movie.
Maybe not. But I think she could have hunted down a black filmmaker for Beloved, and instead went with Jonathan Demme.
All right. And again, I haven't seen the movie. I'm not for or against it. This is just a cultural observation.
But I remember this moment in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And you did come off as somewhat dismissive of the project as a whole because of Jonathan Demme's race. And you didn't even actually give him the credit of being Jonathan Demme. You're just like some white guy.
I was not.
Like, that's kind of how you were.
No.
It is kind of, that's kind of what you did.
We got to go back to the tape on that
one. You can go back to the tape, but that's kind of what you did. Listen, I forgive you.
Oh, that's great. I've seen more Jonathan Demme movies than you have, probably. Have you seen Citizens Band? I doubt it.
You're the best. Pain in my butt.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Don't you forget it.
Let's continue. Dave defended the film, but oftentimes on the internet and podcasts, there's not a Dave there to say, but hold up, the movie is actually interesting and worthwhile for XYZ reasons. I was in a film course with a black professor in college, and she thought Beloved was fascinating, highlighting these supernatural and spiritual elements and just the creativity in the filmmaking as a whole. I think there's a more nuanced conversation to have on films, and I certainly hope that we are taking them at least as seemingly seriously as the filmmakers did when they made them. I hope that some of the terrific movies starring non-white casts by people like Costa Gavras, John Borman, Jonathan Demme, Claire Denis, and others aren't overlooked simply because people think they, by race alone, couldn't have made something profound and deep. No, I fully agree with you. And I know, going back, we had this discussion about Detroit, where, this is a film about a deeply traumatic event. And my question was, was Catherine Bigelow the only person that they could find to do this? So And I still have that question in my head, even though I think the movie's not terrible.
I think it's a great film, actually. I wish more people had given Detroit a chance. But I also think, again, we're dealing with a broader context in which
yes,
white people direct all the movies.
Pretty
white
much.
People direct all the white movies. White people direct all the non-white movies. It's
right.
not like they're calling Gurinder Chadha to step in for Whit Stillman
correct.
On anything.
Right.
You know, so we can't pretend that's not a factor.
Right.
When it's like, oh, wow, I finally get this, you know, important novel or, you know, work of, you know, black American literature or, you know, Japanese American literature or, you know, whatever to the screen. And we're giving it to this guy from Connecticut, you know, like that's, even if that guy from Connecticut is going to do a great job with it, I think because the guys from Connecticut make all the movies, that's why we have to have the conversation.
Right, right. Anyway, okay, well, those are the letters.
All right. Did you guys know that we have a Patreon?
We do. We have a Patreon. I'll tell you all about it right now. You go to patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to that main page, you're going to see a video of us at this very table where we record this very show. And we are talking about the other shows that we do. We do other shows. We do three other podcasts.
Every week.
One of them is about TV. One of them is about food, which I understand is unlikely. But given the fact that we talk about food all the time here.
Why not?
It became a listener-directed project.
It did.
That we decided to take on. We do a podcast about, what do you say? It's current events.
Sure.
Topics. What's in the news? Remember the TV show? Remember the in between the Saturday morning?
This CBS in the news.
1970s. If you were a child, we were children in the 1970s. They had a in between the cartoons. They had a thing called In the News.
Yes,
and it was news for children,
like a 3-minute segment.
How to make sense if you're a child of Watergate or
environmental issues.
What's going on in the Middle East? You know, like, and it was aimed at kids.
Why are oil prices climbing?
Yeah. And that was when you would go get your next bowl of cereal.
I stayed for In the News.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Well,
I like to be informed.
Dave. What a star pupil you were.
I was a sucker for anything that treated children like not children. Like,
listen, I had another bowl of Pink Panther Flakes that I had to chow down on.
Whenever they would, that was always between the cartoons is when I did that. But like, whenever they would, like, after school specials, those specials were like Gabe Kaplan would take you through an art museum or something.
Right.
Or like, you know, Michael Tilson Thomas would explain opera to you. I was all right. for it.
Right.
Anyway, patreon.com/linoleumknife. We have extra shows. We do personalized podcasts.
Yeah.
We have enamel pins and t-shirts and all kinds of groovy swag.
The
so
private
check that
knife,
out.
That's what he was just mentioning.
Yes.
The private knife is where you tell us what you want to hear a podcast mm-hmm. about, and we do one for like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Do we still have Christmas ornaments?
Yeah.
Oh, we have Christmas ornaments?
We have the linoleum knife Christmas ornament. You name a thing, we've probably got something with the words linoleum knife on it.
Indeed. So check that out.
Is there anything else I need to tell people? Oh, yes, there is. This week is July 4th, Independence Day. It mm-hmm. is a national. It's a national holiday in the
yes.
United States. And we will be doing all of the shows still. We're not taking time off. We are going to do what I believe to be a standalone Spider-Man Far From Home episode.
Okay.
Because I'm 99% sure that the guests who said they wanted to come on are still coming on.
Okay.
We're in the middle of sorting out days and times. But I'm 99% sure that they're still coming on,
great.
These two guests, to talk entirely about Spider-Man Far From Home.
Yes. Oh, also, I just want to kind of put this out there into the world. I don't know if I'm on this thing. I don't know if I'm on this thing a little.
Oh,
I don't know if I'm on this thing a lot.
Oh, listen, as often as they called you in to...
I was interviewed on more than one occasion.
And as often as I had to iron the same damn shirt over and over again to make it seem like they shot all your bits in one day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At one point, I literally had to take a screen grab to my barber and be like, I need to look like this again. Anyway, I was interviewed for a CNN series that starts on Sunday, July 7th, called The Movies.
The show is called The Movies. It's on CNN.
Correct.
And it starts a week from today.
Yes, Sunday, July 7th.
Sunday, July 7th. Okay.
And
I didn't know any of that information until just now.
Wow. Well, keep up.
I mean, I knew it was CNN because I knew that's where you wound up going to the, you went to the CNN building. No, you didn't. Oh, okay.
You don't know anything.
Me don't know nothing.
Anyway, this is the state of the world right now. You do a documentary about the movies, and you can't start with silent cinema and work your way forward, or no one's going to tune in. So they're starting with the 80s. So it's like the first episode is the 80s, the second episode is the 90s, the third episode, I think, is the ooze. And then they get back to, like, the old school. And then, anyway, it's like 7 or 8 episodes, I think. This is a big, massive undertaking. I'm in there somewhere. I don't know. So anyway, tune in July 7th to CNN, The Movies.
And the episodes are 2 hours long each.
Yeah.
Right? This is a long Ken Burns style documentary.
Well, it's from the people that did, like, you know, the 70s and the 60s and those previous CNN docs. And they talk to, like, big league people. Like, I have no idea how much I'm in it because, you know, they talk to Spielberg. You know, so who knows?
You're as cool as he is.
You're sweet. Anyway, so that's a thing that's happening. So keep an eye out for it.
Cooler than he is. No,
stop.
I'd rather hang out with you.
Well, fair enough. So that's a thing. Just want to let you know. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. We always love it, and he's at Bluetopia.com. BLEUTOPIA. See what he's up to. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Bibbs and Whitney's shows. Cancel Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Critically Acclaimed, of course, part of the Schmoes No Network. So of course, check out our friends the Schmoes. Listen to Dennis Anuin with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Secretly Timid, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Deck the Hallmark. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave us glowing feedback in all the places that we stream, like Spotify and Stitcher and thelounge.com and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. Follow us at LinoleumCast at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments or your top 10 lists. And, have a lovely and safe July 4th. Those of you in the United States, the rest of you could care less.
Don't explode yourself with firecrackers.
Please don't. It's not, you won't be happy. All right. So until next time.
Goodbye.